are issues that are raised. That independence of a judiciary can be, can just be a buffer that also helps to protect democracy for the future. We've got to also make sure that there is, freedom to assemble, freedom to actually, I mean, what we're seeing in places like Uganda, where candidates being beaten up repeatedly, and so I think we've got to be able to protect opposition, protect that space, that political space for opposition voices, candidates, parties, all to be able to safely conduct electoral affairs. It will take all of us. It is movements. It is an independent press. It is the judiciary. It is everyone working together to protect those instruments, all of those instruments of democracy. And we know it's just much too fragile.
Yes. Now, Kenneth, all that having been said, when you consider what we witnessed, for example, in Ivory Coast, where a president went for a third term, and up to now, the opposition insists that's illegal, where there was a situation in Tanzania where, of course, the opposition had a very difficult time. The presidential candidate had to leave to go to exile soon after the elections. We saw what happened in Guinea, for example, and people have died in those countries. So what would you say, where is the continent overall? Is there progress, or are there steps forward and then several steps back every other few years?
Yeah, thanks, Vincent. Speaking as a lawyer, the challenges that we have really in constitution building that we often do not have what we call a constitutional autochthony, homegrown constitutions. We tend to borrow a lot. If you look at the Commonwealth of Africa, for example, we've borrowed heavily from a Westminster model in the UK, and then some tenets of presidentialism from the US. The US has a presidential system of government. And you have some of these countries like Nigeria, which is a federal state. Others are unitary states, okay? The problems that we are seeing, for example, in Ethiopia, where the ethnically based coalition was sort of brought under one umbrella by the incumbent prime minister, now there's dissatisfaction from the folks who have been in power, like who dominated politics for about the last three decades. It's a similar scenario you're seeing in most of these other countries, ethnic-related type of politics, rather than ideologically based and policy-based type of issues. We are seeing this even in countries like Zambia. As much as people may want to deny it, there's an element of ethnically based type of politics. Malawi was an interesting case, actually, where the incumbent at the time lost Professor Mutharika, Peter Mutharika. But generally speaking, what we are seeing across the board is that we are seeing more of this old style type of democracy of the big man as opposed to big institutions, but the big man type of politics. And that authoritarian type of system where you want to change the constitution. In Uganda, the constitution was amended in 1975 to allow somebody to stand for more than two terms. It was amended again in 2017, December, by the Ugandan parliament to allow somebody above 75 years old to continue running for politics. So these type of situations, the big old man, don't disturb the big old man. Even in the Western world, you see, Democrat, Republicans, the Republican camp was the big old man who came in power. So those things we are seeing of this, even in Europe, UK, you see this old sort of, wielding a lot of political power around him, sort of authoritarian type of things. So it's a global phenomenon, and it's spilling over to Africa as well. We are seeing that.
Although, Amira, in Africa, if you look at historically, the fellows actually who became these big old men came in as young people. So what do you make of their disdain for giving opportunities or the platform or the space to the younger generation? They typically characterize them as being inexperienced. They're not good enough. This is a place for people like me. But yet, when you look at them, most of them came into power when they were young men.
Well, that's the irony, right? I remember actually those days when when you had the Uganda, Rwanda. It was like they were and Ethiopia at the time, right? They were the new leaders of the future, right? So we remember that history, but we also see how quickly there was an effort to do things as my brother Kenneth has said, to kind of change constitution and entrench their power. So I think it is a problem with power politics that is personalized. And I think we've got to figure out how we build, again, this is like building public institutions that are in the interest of the people. It's fundamental, because if you're coming with a sort of trickle down analysis, right, where all the money and resources and power stays within a few hands, and then you trickle down to your cronies, and then you have militaries that are protecting and maybe even a part of those cronies, right? I think it is a system that is ripe for that sort of big man, quite literally man politics, right? But I think we've got to say that there are changes underway. And one of the things I think we have to be proud of on the continent is the elements in those new constitutions where women's political leadership was lifted up. And I think we've got to continue to push for new leaders, new voices, young people to be a part of the political process, to have a sway in the institutions, because ultimately it is the power of the numbers, of particularly of young people, that will shift these efforts to derail democracy and to entrench power for decade after decade. So I think we've got to learn from, this is the 10th anniversary of Tunisia and all of the changes that people power brought were not sustained, but that people power is needed to bring change and to continually push towards greater and more fundamental structural change.
Yes, and Kenneth, you're a lawyer, but when you observe around the continent in politics, people tend to, especially on the continent, to place a lot of goodwill in men and women and just hope for the best. And of course, amazing promises are made until the person gets to power. The formerly opposition guy who was promising everything becomes the today dictator, or with a guy with those dictatorial tendencies. What should be the priority? Should people be concerned too much about who they're going to elect, or kind of speed up the process of establishing the institutions that would protect the citizens against any excesses of the individual politician? Because all human beings have the propensity to abuse power, regardless of where they are.
This is a brilliant question, an excellent question, Vincent. When we're building, for example, capital markets, the argument always comes, should we start with building stock markets or the banking sector, the money economy? Which one comes first, chicken or egg? That type of question. The biggest problem that we're facing in Africa, and what we've been facing in the last two decades or so, is a leadership crisis. Leadership is very, very important. It's through leadership that you're going to build these institutions. You don't expect to build good institutions with really bad leadership or poor type of leadership. So quality leadership is something that we cannot compromise over. We need to get this very clear. And a lot of people who are into politics, some of them are just about to line up their pockets. We need to look at the track record of somebody who's coming into power, where he's coming from, what he has delivered, what he has done, or where he's messed up. We cannot pretend. But we have a tendency of thinking along ethnic lines, like I alluded to earlier on, because this guy comes from the part of the country where I come from. Even if I'm a professor, I'm going to vote for him, because he's my tribesman, he can give me a job. So that type of thinking has to change, okay? The issue of civic education as citizens, we need to be more enlightened about, these processes of electing people. So institutions, yes, they are very important. There's no doubt about it. When we're doing issues of governance, we need strong institutions, but we need leadership to provide us with a vision to build those institutions. Without good leadership, things just go to waste.
And Emira, talk about good leadership. This has to come from society at the same time. But the kind of things Kenneth is talking about need an enlightened populace and enlightened masses. So how do you achieve this? You know, it's one thing to go on the streets and protest and have placards, but it's another thing to have people having that level of awareness and kind of demand for accountability so that they can produce the leaders that they can trust and who can really and realistically implement some of those great ideas.
Yeah, Vincent, that's the crux of the matter, you know, I think the response is that really, you know, we've done it before, so we can do it again, right? So let's remember we've had the Lumumbas, you know, visionary leader that says, you know, basically, you know, the resources of Africa must feed the children of Africa. That means simple, basic, core values. We've had, you know, Sankara, Thomas Sankara, you know, not only did he change the name from Upper Volta, and I nearly forgot, yeah, Upper Volta to, you know, Burkina Faso, land of upright people. But he was so visionary, right? Like, this is the late 1980s, 1987 or so, right? When he was actually saying there should be parity in salaries for men and women. This is coming from Burkina Faso in the late 1980s, well before, it still hasn't happened in the United States or any, you know, many, many other countries around the world. But he did it, right? And was visionary on looking at climate change from then and its impact on our people and on our societies. So I think we have had these visionary leaders. I'm not concerned about whether or not we can create them on the continent. We've done it, right? But I think what we have had is a unfortunate shift in the balance to prioritizing those leaders that are meeting the interests of external actors, right? So Lumumba was replaced, right? We know the story well. Lumumba, you know, we need a whole show to go into all of this, yeah, but right? He was killed and he was replaced by someone who could do the bidding of the West. We know this, right? So we have had far too many examples, right? I mean, too many are coming to mind right now of these leaders that are paying more attention to, you know, capitals in here in Washington or in Europe, you know, or these international institutions, and they're even in terms of their own people. So we've got to know that we have the capacity to do different, and we've got to demand our societies, respond to that need to take a different path.
We do, Kenneth. There's a lot of mention many times of those great leaders, you know, whether it's Nelson Mandela or Lumumba, sure, Thomas Sankara. But then you see there's such a gap between some of those and any other great leader. So is there a lack of appreciation of those so that many more African leaders could be inspired and want to emulate Mandela? Why do we have to be talking about just Mandela? Why can't there be 3-4 other people who have emerged who can fit into that kind of description, or Thomas Sankara, or Lumumba?
One of the biggest challenges we have is what I would call in leadership or management, even in the military, what we call ambidexterity. Yeah, we're living in the present, but to anticipate and think through for the future. We've got data, we've got facts, we've got examples, we've got precedents of good leaders, the Kenneth Kaunda, the Nyereres, the Nkrumahs. But we've abandoned those facts. But, you know, so how do you project the future? How do you foresee the future? You know, living in the present doesn't mean you need not anticipate or contemplate what tomorrow will look like. You can, on the basis of the evidence and the facts of today and the past of history, be able to predict the future. But we have dropped the ball. So we have failed to replicate the type of leadership that we had at independence, the type of leaders who were selfless. You know, most of these guys, well, towards the end, some of them, they got compromised. But in the earlier stages of their tenure, they surely were very Pan-Africanist, very focused, some of them very nationalist. You're talking of the Kaundas, you're talking of the Nyereres, decent people. It's hard to find those type of leaders, not only in Africa, the world over, including in the Caribbean islands, yes, that I can assure you.
Yeah. And you know, Emiro, when you look at some of those leaders you mentioned, one of the things that they had very similar characteristics they had were selflessness. They were not driven by getting wealthy and becoming billionaires. They were self-sacrificing. The Nyereres and all that are not known to have accumulated a lot of wealth. So some say, perhaps what happens is the corruption of power, and especially how it entices people into wanting to amass wealth, and the money part of it, the wealth part of it, the materialistic part of it, becomes the enemy of even the most well-intentioned leader. And thus the association of corruption with many of the bad leaders that we've witnessed across the continent.
Well, we can certainly discuss that. I think that there's a universal line of power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That comes to mind, right? But I think we've got to see how the visionary leaders emerged. Many of them, the ones that we've mentioned here, Lumumba, came out of trade union movements, came out of movements, came out of a liberation struggle, right? So they shared a certain ethos, a demand for justice. They were one with the people. So I think we've got to understand what that brings, and know that we have leaders that are emerging today in these movements that are also standing with the people, that are also looking at, challenging, what racist capitalist structures, as they say so beautifully, right? It's like they're understanding these economic structures and how they have oppressed our people, and what we need to do differently, because they're walking on this road, and they're sort of with the people. So I think we've got to look to how leadership evolves, and we've got to see the leadership, through this lens of who's actually lifting up the voices of those who have been most oppressed and marginalized, and how are they doing it? And right now, I think we do. We've got leaders that are coming out of a climate justice movement across the continent that are saying, climate change is disastrous for the planet, but as Nimmo Bassi's, one of the brilliant leaders so well says, is cooking a continent. And it is these leaders that I think we've got to lift up, as a continent and as a people, is to lift up those voices. And many of them, I have to say, they're women, they're young people that are demanding change, because they understand the pain that these structures have brought in their lives, and they are at the forefront of pushing for change. And so I see it's just a different way of conceptualizing leadership that's needed, so that we're able to make sure that they are evolving in ways that they can seize political power and use that political power to lift up human dignity.
Kenneth, I wanted to just ask you one thing that could wrap up our program. Throughout the 2020, what did Africa learn, or what could Africa learn about its relationship with the global community? Because we know that, for example, so many Western countries were so focused on survival, on taking care of the economies, that they couldn't, there are no time or opportunity now to focus on helping the continent. So what are the lessons for the continent of Africa?
Thanks, Vincent. The ambivalence of the post-colonial African state cannot be overstated. Their governance, sort of governing class interests locally, domestically within Africa, their ruling class sort of colonial ties, the Francophone Africa, you tie the French Francophone Africa ties there. We have seen the influence of what's coming through from China in terms of investment in Africa, the issues of trade barriers against exports from Africa. We've seen some of those challenges. So Africa is now caught up in the chasm between the two sort of blocks, the West and China. Then we have this coronavirus pandemic. Then we had droughts in countries like Zambia, which affected hydropower generation, electricity, for example, continuous blackouts. Agriculture sector was affected. So there are all these challenges. Then you have pockets of conflict. We have what's going on currently in Ethiopia. Hopefully that will be resolved. You go to Nigeria, Boko Haram there. There's a lot of noise and so forth. But above all, the greatest learning experience that I would say comes to the fore is the importance of quality leadership on the African continent. Yes, Africa is a big continent of about 53 countries. There are some examples, and I would not want to mention names because people, of course, disagree here and there. But I have a lot of admiration, for example, for President Kagame and the work that he's doing in Rwanda. Rwanda is doing exceptionally well in terms of, you know, economic growth and development and so forth. Botswana also has shown to be a very stable country over the years. So there are good lessons of experience. It's not that Africa is hopeless. There are some good examples, even within Africa. You know, we can learn. Why is Rwanda doing so well? What is it that others will say, well, Kagame is a dictator. They will come up with their own arguments. But the bottom line is the economy is growing, and they are doing so well. Okay? So those are some of the issues I think that we need to think through very well. Thank you so much.
Vincent, I'm wanting to jump in because, you know, I feel like, how has Kagame done what he's done? Clearly, because he's a dictator. One, you look at the recent abduct. How do you abduct the hero from Hotel Rwanda, from an airport in Dubai, and he somehow ends up, you know, like imprisoned in Kigali? Like, how do you do that? That is absolutely the best example of a repressive government that is going in absolutely the wrong direction, not only for their own people, but then across the border. They're in the Democratic Republic of the Congo controlling the mines, right? And getting the wealth from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so don't, Vincent, that's a whole nother show. So don't get me started on that one, right? You know, but I think clearly when we I think your question was about lessons. So let me refocus on that. The lessons, right? Clearly we're at a crossroads.
I'm with you. There are two schools of thought. There are two schools of thought: economic determinism versus the issue of human rights. So you are expressing the issue of human rights, but there's argument of economic determinism.
I'm saying even on the economic determination, you cannot grow your economy at the expense of your neighbors across the border whose minds you're controlling. That cannot happen. We've got to look at opportunities of doing things differently. Not, you know, again, I'm from Liberia, where we had the history of Charles Taylor, you know, going across the border, getting the diamonds to fuel his own interests, right? This is not sustainable, and it's not the future of the continent that we need. So we'll leave that for another show, Vincent. Yeah. But what I wanted to emphasize, as we, I know you said the time is short, right, is that we're at a critical crossroads. It's not only this pandemic, but we know there will be future pandemics. One. Second, we are at, the UN tells us we have less than a decade now to avoid climate chaos. Less than a decade to basically protect the people on this planet from this devastation, as we've heard. It's like, you know, it's the increased droughts, it's increased desertification, it's the rising sea levels in places, all of those capital cities that are along the oceans, right, that are already underwater. So we've got to recognize that as a continent and as a people, we're in a critical moment. And now is the time to kind of, you know, to seize the opportunities.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Emily. Get the last word there. And on that note, our distinguished guests are Emily Woods and Kenneth Mwenda. And thanks to our audience for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. Have a good evening.